Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, my hometown. It's been cold and windy there. It's been on the verge of turning warm and sunny, and just when you think it will, we get a little bit of snow. Typical for Minnesota at this time of year. Those poets who wrote about spring as a time of love and romance were not from Minnesota, I can tell you that. If your love life was like spring in Minnesota, you would want to consider celibacy, I think, as an option. So the regulars were sitting the other day in the Chatterbox Cafe, and they were complaining about the things that we complain about in my town, about the weather, about cars, about kids, and about politicians. They were complaining, although they had just finished the most wonderful macaroni and cheese you could ever have for lunch. Dorothy makes it, and she makes it better than ever. She uses a little bit less cheese, and she uses a stronger cheese on it, Parmesan cheese. And it's the best macaroni and cheese you'd ever find. You just sit there, and tears come to your eyes. And then when you're done with it, you get a piece of rhubarb pie. Rhubarb pie, there are people in this audience recognize that term. And they know that it's the secret of the good life as we know it. It's a pie that you'd never find in a fine restaurant in a big city. It's a pie that's only made for you by somebody who knows you and loves you. And that's what makes it so wonderful. Money would never be motivation enough to make rhubarb pie that well. Fame, a person wouldn't make it for fame. It's made by somebody who knows you and cares about you. You see, in a small town, we make a virtue of a necessity, and we believe that familiarity is good for people, and we believe that anonymity brings out the worst in people so often. This probably is not true, but we believe it. You look at people on the freeways, probably very nice people at home, but in the anonymity of the interstate, they become vicious. And they would run you off the road rather than let you merge into their traffic jam. They'll curse at you. They're probably wonderful people at home with their friends and their family, but you put them behind glass with locks on their doors and they become psychopaths. So we don't have privacy in Lake Wobegon because we believe that it's not good for you. We know everybody's life, and we hope this brings out the best in people, though we're not sure. But at least it's the convenience. When you sit in the Chatterbox Cafe, you don't have to complain about your hard life because everybody knows about your life. So you can just sit there and complain about children and cars and the weather and about politicians. One of the regulars sits there and says, I don't call this spring what we have. They're just terrible. We have about 5 months of winter, and it's followed by 2 months of misery, and then suddenly it's summer. It happens year after year after year. Somebody says, kids nowadays. Look at them. You ever see them volunteer to pick up a broom or do any work around the home? No, you don't either. Act sullen around you. Kids just go around looking like a bunch of punks. They want this defiant look. But you sit at home, and your kid suddenly walks in all sweet and sensitive. And you don't even need to ask what for. You just reach for your billfold and you say, how much? Kids nowadays. And there's a pause in the conversation, and somebody starts in on cars. Cars nowadays. It used to be you could fix a car. You could fix a car yourself. You could even put up a block and pulley on a tree and you could pull the engine out of it. You could change the engine in a car. Now, you'd need $500,000 worth of equipment to do it. It's all electronic. and they take the alternator and they stick it way underneath and in the back. You'd have to pull out the engine to change an alternator. So you got to go in and pay $300 to get an alternator changed. Just a scandal. What's going on with cars in this country? But Carl Krebsbach sat down at the end of the counter, and he did not join in the complaints about cars or weather, because he'd heard the complaints about children, and it made him think. He's a mysterious man, Carl. We think we know him, but he is a carpenter, and carpenters do tend to keep their own thoughts. It was 25 years ago that Carl Krebsbach came back to Lake Wobegon from the Army. And all the time he was in the Army, he had been writing to his girlfriend, Anne Marie Meister. And in the course of writing to her, had discovered to his amazement that he was not in love with her, though he'd tried so hard to be, and kept on saying that he was, in hopes that repetition would help. He was not in love with her, and that bothered him, because how could anyone not be? She was so wonderful. She was so beautiful and dark and light and so unlike her lumbering family out there on their potato farm. She was funny, and she wrote wonderful letters. So when he got home from the Army, he determined to try to be in love with her. And as a favor to her and to her family, he went out that spring and he built a house for her father. Carl hated to build houses because it took so long. You had to look at your work for weeks and months and see all your mistakes and get discouraged. But he built a house for them, a three-bedroom rambler, out in the raspberry patch, out behind the old white frame house there on the Meister's potato farm that the Meisters built when the great-grandfather came over from Bavaria over 100 years ago. The Meisters were sailmakers in Germany, and they brought their tools with them when they came. And when they landed out on the prairie, they looked around and realized that a terrible mistake had been made. But as Germans will do, they refused to admit this. And they settled down, and through great stubbornness, they achieved a measure of contentment. He set in to build this house, and it dawned on him, as they got into the summer, that Mr. Meister was under the impression that Carl and Anne Marie were going to marry and live in this new house, and that Mr. Meister and the missus were going to live in the old house, except for about 6 months of the year they'd be down in Florida living off the money that Carl was going to pay them for a half share in the potato farm. Well, Carl had no idea how they got this idea whatsoever. He tried to discourage him. He said, "I don't know about farming, Mr. Meister. I don't think I'm cut out to be a farmer." "Oh," Mr. Meister said, "it's no problem at all. Potatoes, easiest thing in the world. Once your back gets used to it, it's like second nature." Well, he went on building that house, and he's trying hard to fall in love with Anne Marie. Worked hard every day, and every night they go swimming in Lake Wobegon out to a secluded inlet on the north end of the lake. And they go out there swimming, and they lie in the moonlight and talk and dry off in the moonlight. And one day, the old man came to Carl there where he was building the house, and he had papers drawn up, a bill of sale to sell him half of the potato farm. Anne Marie was pregnant by then, but Carl wasn't aware of it. He might have guessed, but he didn't. He said to Mr. Meister, "Mr. Meister," he said, "I have no interest whatsoever in raising potatoes. I'm sorry that you ever thought so. And he picked up his tools. The house was almost done. And he went home. He didn't find out about Anne Marie's pregnancy until about a month later when her brother Albert told him. Albert, who'd just gotten out of the Marines, came over to Carl's parents' house where Carl was staying. And he drew up a chair at the kitchen table. And he looked at Carl. And he said, "You have abused my sister and misused her and committed the grossest sort of immorality. And you have made false promises to my parents. You have dishonored my family. And if I were to pick up this butcher knife and drive this butcher knife into your heart, and I could do it, I don't think there's a jury in this county would ever convict me. But I'm not talking about marriage, Carl. I wouldn't even suggest it. I wouldn't care for my sister to be married to a person of your morals. But you do owe my family a debt, and I intend to see that you pay it off. You can do a little bit of work for me. I'll see you at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning." So Carl built a second house. For her brother. He hated it. He hated building houses. But he built it there on the outskirts of town. And in the meantime, he'd met Marjorie Hoag, a lovely woman whom he knew he was going to marry. The house was finished by Christmas, and Carl and Marjorie got married in February. Anne Marie had gone away to the cities in the fall, and the baby was born in March and put up for adoption. And Anne Marie stayed in the cities. Carl had a dream after the baby was born. He saw an angel in the dream who brought him the child, and it was a beautiful child. But the angel was not a beautiful angel. It wasn't one of those pre-Raphaelite angels. It was his sergeant from the army. A squat, unshaven man who smelled bad, but nonetheless was clearly an angel, and looked at him in the dream and said, "Carl, you've been playing around, and I hope that you enjoyed it. But don't feel that this is going to be a way of life, and don't think that you have a right to do this. You were playing around only because I allowed it. And now your leave is up. Semper Fidelis, Carl. Semper Fidelis. And when your old sergeant says Semper Fidelis, he does mean semper." Well, Carl married Marjorie, and they raised a family. He didn't feel like building himself a house. They just bought an old house in town. Anne Marie was down in the cities, and in 7 heroic years, she put herself through the university and through graduate school. She joined the Foreign Service, and she went off to a post in Zurich, where, after a couple of years, she met a Swiss restaurateur named Hans Zumsteg. She married him, and they lived in a big stone manor in that beautiful city near the Arboretum, near the big lake, the Zurich See, and they raised a family. Carl never heard much from her, didn't hear anything for years, until just after Christmas, she wrote to him. She said, "It's my 25th anniversary," she said. "My 15th anniversary." She said, "I was so angry at you in the past, and now I am so grateful to you. if you had not done the wrong thing by me, I don't think I would have been nearly so happy as I am today. She said that she had heard from his son, the son that they had had that he'd never seen. The son had gotten her name through the adoption agency, and she'd written to him. He was a fine young man, 23 years old. His name was Benjamin, and he lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And he sounded wonderful in the letter, bright and funny and making something of his life. She wrote to Carl. She said, he looks just like you, at least just like you used to look. She said, I gave him your name and your address. I hope that was all right. Carl has been in a state of high excitement since then. And every time the phone rings in his house, he jumps up and runs to it, thinking it will be that voice that he can hardly imagine. It's been 3 months now, and he wonders, why doesn't that boy call? It would be a problem, of course. What would his wife say? She's so jealous about his past. And his kids, the ones he had by Marjorie, what would they think of it? And all the people in town would talk about it. They'd have to ask him about it. Carl hates attention. The thought of people asking him about his feelings is painful to him. But he does wish that boy would go. He'd love to meet him. He'd love to go to Milwaukee and see him. He'd kind of like to go and build him a house. That's the news from Lake Wobegon. Where all the women are strong, all the men are good looking, and all the children are above average.